Good morning and welcome back to our WAMC Roundtable panel. It is wonderful to have you with us. We welcome your input, roundtable at WAMC.org, as we always do. Roundtable at WAMC.org. Also, you can always comment on our webpage. You can also go to our Facebook page. You can tweet at us, which is at WAMC Roundtable. Or just tweet us at WAMC Roundtable, and we'd love to hear and read what is on your mind. What I've noticed is that people work up their anger till about 5:30, and then they nail
you.
Yeah. And so if you can sort of bottle it up during the show, we can actually read it and do. And take care of it. It feels much better. Joining me for the discussion this morning, WAMC newsman Ray Graff, Daily Gazette editor Judy Patrick. Good morning, Judy.
Good morning, Joe.
To have you back. Thank you. And University at Albany journalism professor and investigative reporter Rosemary Armeo. Thank you all for being here. Wonderful. So, Rosemary, the bad news for this first story we'll do, and the bad news for you on this, is that unfortunately you just came back from a trip, and then they make this legal. But electronics on planes.
I always did it anyway.
Really?
I always thought that was a ridiculous and stupid rule. If it were really dangerous to have cell phones or iPads and the rest on the plane, they wouldn't let you have them, just like you can't have a gun on a plane. So it always seemed like a ridiculous rule, and now, of course, research has backed me up.
I don't know. How much research has been done on this issue? In reading about it, it seems like there's been a debate over what impact there really was. And I think they felt more recently that so many people were doing it, as you say, anyway. And we're talking about using electronic devices for people who fly regularly or even sporadically. You are told when you get on the plane that once you are getting ready, once the flight attendants sit down at the beginning of the flight, you have to power down anything that has an on-off switch. So that is a Kindle, your smartphone, your a Nintendo game, whatever the case may be. All of that has to be powered down. Now they've said you can keep those on. However, the two big exceptions are A, you can't use your cell phone for service in flight. You can't, while you are flying, you can't actually use the cell service, nor can you pick up internet service under a certain altitude.
Right.
I'll have to say, I actually have, I did not know that it was even possible to get a cell service until, and this is tragic, but on 9/11, when we heard so many stories about people who were using their cell phones to call loved ones and talk to them, and I didn't even know.
Notice that did not bring down the plane. It was the terrorists who brought down the plane.
Right. So why now, do you think?
I think there's been increasing pressure. The Wall Street Journal has been writing about this for a long time, that there's just nothing that supports the idea that you can't have these machines on. They're not, like, interfering with signals or any of that. And the FCC even has left it up to the airlines. My personal cynical view is that the airlines are looking for some way to charge you, that you won't be able to use any of these things without paying for the service, just like, getting a drink of water now you pay for. I don't know.
Do you really?
Yeah, I really do. I'm very cynical.
No,
about
I mean, you
this.
Really have to pay for. I don't fly too much. It's been 12 or 13 years. So
you don't have to actually pay for water, but you now have to ask for it. They used to bring it routinely on international flights. Now you have to ask for it.
Wow.
And you pay for everything else. Yeah.
So in the, and there's no food.
And the issue that you can't use your cell phone apparently is an FCC issue. And I read something this morning that it described it, that they're worried about the cell phone system coming down if all these telephones on all these planes are trying to contact these towers. And as they move across the country, you're trying to contact a million towers at once.
Interesting. I would have thought it was concern about the sensitive electronics on the plane and possible. I mean, we've all heard it here in the studio. Someone has their cell phone on, even on quiet. It'll come through the wires of our headphones and we'll hear them.
My cell phone is on right now and I'm probably irradiating all of our listeners. I don't know. I think it's crazy. I want to see proof of it. And then if it is really dangerous, I don't want anybody carrying it. I don't know. I also think that part of the reason for the rule about shutting it off is they want your attention on a plane. It's really important that the flight attendants, that the captain has the attention of passengers. And in fact, these new rules say that you have to keep it powered down while they're doing those safety things, like, you know, this is a seatbelt. It goes together like this. We have to hear that again.
Well, I know, but you know, you have to.
You're such a jaded flyer.
I really am. I think there's, and I also don't like the English they use. The boarding process. What is a boarding process? You mean boarding? And stow. Whoever said, stow your stuff away. And then the other thing in this rule, really, I don't get me going on airlines.
Wow. She'll be here all week.
Okay, and did you see the latest thing? This is now that they don't have, the flight attendants don't have to go around saying, please shut off your machine. They now are going to monitor what you put in the pocket, the seat pocket in front of you. Oh, thank God. I've worried about that during flying, too.
Well, the big thing is putting your laptop in the seat pocket front. That's bad. They won't let you do that.
You know, meanwhile, I fly in Africa, Europe, Asia, and none of these rules apply. I mean, you put your seat, you can put your suitcase on the seat next to you. You can even close the blinds while you're landing, and there's no crashes.
I didn't know you couldn't do that.
No, yeah. I didn't either.
No.
You can't. Oh, no, you can't. The flight attendant will go back and please raise the blinds.
Ellen DeGeneres, when she was a stand-up, used to have a great routine where she would say, you know, about the seatbacks, the seatbacks always had to be up. And she'd take up her hand and she'd put it straight up and she'd say, alive. And then she'd put one back like an inch and say, dead. Alive. Dead. Like that was the difference. That was going to make the difference between, you know, that inch.
The airlines, you know, open themselves to this. Stand-up comedians have made money off of them for ages. Was it George Carlin who used to say the little safety intro was for people who had never ridden in a car for the last, you know, 20 years? You know, this is a seatbelt. It goes like this.
This is to your point, though, Rosemary. I do want to read at the risk of winding you up again. We love it. Passengers will still be prohibited from browsing the web and checking email once the plane's doors have been closed and until its, and I think that's the key word, its Wi-Fi network has been turned on, usually above 10,000 feet.
So small feet to connect.
You're right. They found a way now to successfully monetize it, and now it's okay. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think you're onto something.
I mean, you can even look at airports. How come some of them are free? Wi-Fi is free, like at Albany Airport, for example, and many other places you have to pay to get on.
And also, the good old days where you could find a plug. Good luck now.
Well, they're opening. You'll now see stands where it's charge here.
Some of the charge stations, yeah, but in some of the other airports, they keep them away from you. And I think they've like taken the outlets away because they don't want you.
Yeah.
It's an interesting.
Yeah, just a little customer service there. No, you can't charge.
But they're going to put plugs on planes, I hear. And
interesting. Like on trains. They have them on trains now.
Which, if you're on a long trip, your phone's going to run down pretty quickly.
Right.
There.
Right.
Yeah, absolutely. And there are a lot of issues. And one of the issues was the flight attendants really had no way to determine whether a cell phone is really off or it's really in the airplane mode.
Right. I've never been caught.
No, see, I always take that deadly seriously.
Me too.
I always turn it right off. I'm like, I don't want to screw anything up.
I left my tray down once to see what would happen.
Oh, my. You rebel.
Oh, so you're just playing with them.
I am. I'm toying with them.
they said that while flight attendants have no effective way to determine whether a cell phone or a tablet is really in airplane mode during flight, officials say there's no safety problem if they're not, but you're going to arrive at your destination with a dead battery because the device would continue looking for a cell connection. It would not find it. So they feel like they're getting a little, you know.
It's a service they provide. We're making you shut off your phone so you'll have battery power when you arrive at your destination.
The airlines, for their part in all of this, and while we're on them, the airlines were very much for these rule changes because they wanted to enhance the customer experience. They didn't want you to stow your electronics. They wanted you to actively use that.
Have you ever used that verb before?
To stow away? No. I mean, unless we were talking about like going to a drive-in.
Oh.
Okay. Right? You know, you stow away in the trunk, right?
You're right.
Yeah, you're a stowaway. Let's take a break. We'll be back and talk about other issues of the day. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.
Support for WAMC comes from Steve Lewis Subaru, Hadley, Massachusetts, a new and used Subaru dealer serving the Pioneer Valley, Hartford, and Springfield, offering new Subarus plus used cars, trucks, and SUVs. SteveLewisSubaru.com. Troy Cloth and Paper, offering their own line of stationery, art prints, and apparel designs, eco-minded silkscreen printing services, and silkscreen classes in downtown Troy. TroyClothandPaper.com. And H. Houston Son True Value Hardware and Just Ask Rentals, Woodstock, New York, locally owned since 1932, providing tools and materials for home care projects. True value. Start right. Start here. HHoused.com.
Welcome back to our roundtable panel, and we welcome your input, roundtable at WAMC.org, roundtable at WAMC.org. Rosemary Armeo is here, in case you didn't notice. Judy Patrick is here, and Ray Graff joins us as well. We welcome your comments, roundtable at WAMC.org. Let's talk about stop and frisk. A federal appeals court on Tuesday halted a sweeping set of changes to the New York Police Department's practice of stopping and frisking people on the street, and in strikingly personal terms criticized the trial judge's conduct and removed her from the case. The Court of Appeals for the Second Circuit ruled that the judge, Ashira Scheinlin, ran afoul, their words, of the judiciary's code of conduct by compromising the appearance of impartiality surrounding this litigation. The panel criticized how she had steered the lawsuit to her courtroom when it was filed nearly 6 years ago. The ruling effectively puts off a battery of charges that Judge Scheinlin of Federal District Court in Manhattan had ordered for the police department. It postpones the operations of the monitor who asked to oversee reforms of the stop and frisk practices, which Judge Scheinlin had said violated the constitutional rights of minorities. So I guess we have We have two issues here, of course. There is the action of the judge, and then there's the issue itself, right? Mm-hmm. So, and it seems that when somebody takes an action like this, obviously one muddies the other. Mm-hmm. And I don't know what you do to extract that.
You know, on this decision, it's all next week's election in New York City may nullify what's happening here. It all depends on who gets elected. And I mean, de Blasio has come out in favor of or not in support of this policy, and he may just drop the city's appeals of this.
When it comes to stop and frisk, I mean, it is certainly a very controversial. It's a controversial practice. And it seems that as I just read in this article that this has been that this debate has been going on for nearly 6 years, so and that's just the legal challenge to it. But as you see it, what are the issues? What do you think? How do you defend it? I guess.
Yeah, I think Judy's right. It's kind of silly, really, to talk about the merits of that case right now because it could all change in a very short period
probably
of time.
Probably will.
But what's really interesting to me, I thought, was the criticism of the judge. This is no slouch of a judge. If you look her up, she did the Gotti trials. She's done a number of. She's a real outspoken, straight in your face, very direct woman. Oh, you can tell why I would like that. And she never treats the government as deserving of special kind of attention in her courtroom. She cuts them no slack, which explains why she is not popular with the police or the city government. And her offense in this was that they called it steering the cases into her courtroom. What she did was use a law that does exist, a rule that exists in the court, that if you've handled one kind of case, you can take related court cases. And back a long time ago, she did a federal case that, in a very brief way, had handled these kind of stop and search and seizure things. And she said, this is an interesting case. I think you could call it related. I would be interested in seeing that. Lo and behold, New York people take that as a hint. They write up the case and it ends up in her courtroom. Is that really bad? It certainly is judicial activism, but of a sort that's banned, that even by the rules that exist. We have this big debate going on at all levels in the judiciary of how involved they should get in lawmaking. Seems to me she just kind of pressed the envelope and now she's getting slapped for it.
And taking the cases that you think are important and taking the cases
that you're passionate about,
that
you know something about. Yeah.
And you want to have a
say in.
Yeah. And it's Judge Shenlin, by the way. I was mispronouncing
it.
Shenlin.
It's a funny name.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And which I think has a lot to do because Judge Judy Shenlin, and there was a lot of people who thought that they were related, and they're not. So there was a differentiation, and she's very clear about the name, so Shenlin.
She also has talked to the press a lot, and that doesn't make her popular with judicial colleagues. But she put out a statement saying, you know, I did not talk about this case directly. She knows those rules, I think, and sticks right to them. She's just controversial.
You know, it can be frustrating when you're dealing with judges sometimes. Right next week, you have an election. We've got people running for judgeships, and they never talk about issues. And I think the public would be better served, as long as we're going to vote for judges, let them talk about some issues. I agree that they don't need to they can't talk about specific cases, but this idea that we're just going to talk about what our credentials are and not talk about where they might stand on a particular issue or where their leanings might be is ridiculous. Especially if we're going to continue to elect judges. I know I'm off topic a little bit, but
I think it's a great topic. Yeah. And how much of it is mandated, and how much of it is by personal choice of what they decide to talk about?
Is it written in law? I don't think it's written in law. It may be just peer pressure,
practice, and peer pressure.
Yeah. Of what is expected of a judge that you don't discuss. How you would rule in a certain case.
But I you know, pity the poor voters next week when they have to choose, you know, Supreme Court justices, local, you know, at state level Supreme Court justices, and they don't know who they're voting for except what parties they're running on and where they went to college and law school.
Mm-hmm. And that's from my knowledge, most do not participate in any debates of any kind.
Oh, no. That would be interesting, though.
Yeah. Yeah. Whereas district attorneys, of course, do, those running for that office.
They will certainly talk about issues.
Yeah.
That is an interesting distinction. I don't know if judges should be elected. I don't know if that's the greatest procedure. But if you are going to have them elected, then let's have a real choice here.
What do you think is going to happen? As you say, a lot will depend on the race. But what do you think will happen with Judge Shenlin and ultimately with stop and frisk?
I think it's going to be moot. I think the Democrats going to get in, and they're not going to have stop and frisk anymore as soon as Bloomberg is out. As for the judge, that's interesting. I mean, she could end up in a judicial review for this, right? The appeals court has said she's guilty of misconduct. So I'd like to see that, how that would come out. I don't know.
When you think about a case like this, because she, as you mentioned, came under fire for talking to reporters, I believe, with both Newsday and
Vanity Fair, I think she
Vanity
spoke
Fair,
to also.
And then in the news interviews criticized by the appeals judges, Shenlin spoke to reporters after the Bloomberg administration leaked statistics on her rulings in an effort to show that she found against police more often than other federal judges. She called the leak a below-the-belt attack, which seems like it may have been. I don't know.
She did more than that, too. She presented statistics on the types of cases she had ruled on. And then there was one whole class of cases which are basically routine. All judges basically rule that same way. She said, you take that class out, and my rulings are much more even-handed than the administration would have you believe. It did look like a smear attack. And that's okay, too. They want to win. They want to win their point of view as well.
Do you think that how much of this in our judicial system do you think has to do with is there a gender issue here?
Ooh. Hmm. Well, there are certainly more male judges than female at this level, but no, I wouldn't. I can't see it. I can't see it. Do you, Judy?
No, I didn't. I didn't see it either.
Yeah, because it was something that was mentioned in one of the, and I believe it was maybe the Atlantic that wrote about it that had that brought that.
I'm pretty sensitive to those issues, but I don't feel it in this one. I think it's more the nature of what a judge does rather than the gender.
When we come back, we have more topics to talk about and discuss. We always welcome your input. It is roundtable at WAMC.org. You can also go to our Facebook page or our webpage, or you can tweet at WAMC Roundtable, at WAMC Roundtable, and reach us there, and we would love to hear from you as well. WAMC.org, roundtable at WAMC.org. We'll be back after this short break. Welcome back to our roundtable panel discussion this morning, or as we say in the States, our roundtable panel discussion.
Right.
And thank you very much, Ray. Ray Graff is with us, Judy Patrick and Rosemary Armeo, and we welcome your comments. We have a few comments, mostly regarding the airlines and survival tips when traveling. Bring a triple plug-in adapter, even if the few sockets near the gates are taken, most people will share the outlet. So they're saying if there's just one, put one of those things in where you get multiple outlets, you know, so bring a power strip and you're all set. That's a good travel tip.
I have a power strip in my bag.
Do they let you bring power strips on the plane?
So far, I haven't had trouble with that.
She doesn't care about rules. You know, you heard her.
TSA. Man, what's the power strip for?
Julia says, Rosemary, if you leave your seat back reclined and your tray down during landing and an accident occurs in which you, for example, are injured somehow by the tray, would you sue?
Mm-hmm. No, nor would I accept blame for the crash either.
And James Sidley just simply writes, Rosemary Dangerfield, go.
Yeah, exactly. Hey, I tell you what, I was on a plane, and no respect at all.
All right, so let's get back to the issues of the day and our topics. And I just, you know, sometimes I read articles and they make them sound like everybody knows that something is happening. And I have no idea that this was going on. And there was an article in the Los Angeles Times in the science section of the LA Times. They posted it last night. And the FDA said that it was taking steps to prevent and resolve prescription drug shortages. I did not know that there were any prescription drug shortages. The U.S. Food and Drug Administration announced Thursday that it was stepping up efforts to prevent and address prescription drug shortages, calling the shortfalls a significant public health threat. In addition to expanding early reporting requirements for drug manufacturers, the FDA said it was launching a smartphone app that would give consumers instant information on pharmaceutical shortages. The question I have here, which maybe is a basic question, but if you're a doctor, shouldn't you know that before you prescribe the medication?
You know, I have a question, too. Is an app going to solve the problem or just make me more worried?
No, apps solve everything, Judy. Come on, cut it out. That and Angry Birds.
Right. You may die of your illness, but at least you'll be happier playing Angry Birds. Exactly. Yeah.
I think you're right, Ray. That's very astute.
Apps solve everything, sure. Helpful. And besides, the government's so good with computer stuff. So I think this is really going to work out well for everyone.
But apparently there are hundreds of these drugs that potentially are in short supply at any time.
And right. So even if you know, but again, this is the point of okay, you get the information out there. And I think you're absolutely right, Judy. I mean, is an app just so you know that it doesn't have it? Okay, but if you have the prescription in your hand for this particular medication and there is a shortage of it, then then you know it's not available, but it's still not available whether you find out on your app or you find out when you get to the pharmacy.
I think doctors know. I mean,
is there a way we can blame the big drug companies for this? Why are there shortages? If they could sell these products and make money, what's the advantage to them to not just solving them themselves? Why is this a problem government has to be involved in?
These are all good questions. Here are some figures. According to this is a quote from Janet Woodcock, who is the director of the FDA Center for Drug Evaluation and Research. She said, "The complex issues of drug shortages continues to be a high priority of the FDA, and early notification is a critical tool that helps mitigate or prevent looming shortages." From 2010 to 2012, the nation experienced 546 shortages. And this is what I was saying of these things. I just didn't know that this was even an issue. 399 of which involved sterile injectable drugs. Most of these shortages were caused by quality and manufacturing issues. So I guess this goes back to things like drug companies. The drug companies, but also a lot like the flu vaccine, where then it turns out to be bad. They have to run the batch. It's bad. And then they have a shortage of the flu vaccine. So it seems like it's that type of model of problem.
And that was a special case, was it not? Because there was such huge demand at a specific time for it. It wasn't spread out over a long period of time so you could fix it.
And there's an expiration date. So you have a window of time to do it.
I wonder if patent law has anything to do with this too. In other words, somebody has a proprietary formula, and it's a needed drug. It's successful. It does its job really well.
No generics.
Exactly.
Right.
You know, you change a molecule, but maybe there's litigation and everything else involved.
Right.
There is also, it says others were caused, this other shortages were caused by a lack of raw materials and components from suppliers. Drug supply shortages reached an all-time high in 2010. I'm just going to read these statistics, and I want you to follow the timeline. And the overall point of this is how great is government.
Okay.
Drug supply shortages reached an all-time high in 2010, prompting a 2011 executive order from the president to address the issue. The FDA then implemented reporting requirements for manufacturers at that time and was also required to draft a strategic plan for preventing shortages and mitigating the drug shortages. The strategic plan was released Thursday.
Yeah.
Jeez.
So we reached a critical point in 2010.
Well,
we have our plan now, which is an app.
They've been busy.
Yeah.
I've been very busy.
You know, there's also a website you can go to and find all the answers to this too, but it doesn't really solve the problem. It'll tell you how many drugs are in short supply. They won't tell you exactly which drugs they are or what you need to worry about if you have a particular health condition, but we also have a website.
And again, the new actions the FDA now plans to undertake include improving the agency's communications about shortages, clarifying drug makers' roles and responsibilities in the face of a shortage, which is, I think, what we're looking for more information on of exactly what that means and what the drug manufacturers can do. The one thing I don't think I mentioned this, though, that one of the problems is caused by a lack of raw materials and components from suppliers. So actually getting the stuff to make the drugs.
I think doctors are fairly well aware of this. I know this has happened with something that one of my kids was prescribed, and it was something fairly innocuous. I don't even remember what it was, but they said, "Oh yeah, we haven't been able to get that for 6 months." So they did a workaround. Yeah. So I think some of these are not life-saving prescriptions, but some are, obviously.
Well, we're so
they're in no trouble with ibuprofen, right?
Right. No. Well, and look, I'm certain that I understand your point completely. But let's assume that if you're being prescribed a drug, that in some way, shape, or form, you need it.
Yeah.
And you know that's why a shortage is somewhat somewhat troubling. But again, these drugs do seem to have in common that they are injectable drugs.
Right.
So if anyone would like to comment on that issue, we would love to hear from you. Roundtable at WAMC.org. Judy, let's go to you and go for a much lighter topic. something that won't be at all controversial. That is making headlines both regionally and internationally, we should note.
Are you talking about the Constitution Pipeline?
Yeah, I am.
So there's a proposal to build a 124-mile natural gas pipeline from Pennsylvania to Schoharie County, which is just outside of Albany. And that pipeline is now before the federal regulators. We have a story in today's paper about grassroots grassroots watchdog groups helping the landowners who are along the route. The pipeline company is going through and they're surveying the property to see where this pipeline should go. The big thing about it is it probably will mostly go up the I-88 corridor, which is a big interstate, but it will also cross some private property, and people out there are concerned about where it will go, about whether it would be on their property. The pipeline company says, you know, we're working with people. We don't go on people's property unless, you know, we've asked them about it. The grassroots groups that are basically against this pipeline, they're out there to protect the people about it. It's a huge pipeline, and it's going to bring natural gas that has come out of the Marcellus Shale in Pennsylvania. So it will come to Schoharie County, and then it will be piped east, probably into New England. This pipeline will carry enough natural gas to service, I think, 3 million homes. It's like a $684 million project. So it's a huge project before federal regulators now. And as it comes across the Southern Tier, we're starting to see these issues about landowners dealing with the company about whether or not this pipeline is going to cross their land.
So the grassroots organizations, are they largely property rights organizations, or are they against natural gas from the Marcellus Shale?
I think the latter. One of the groups is called Stop the Pipeline. So, but I think they're out there to protect the property owners at the same time as part of their ongoing effort. The idea that about transmission of large quantities of natural gas is a concern. I mean, we've had some problems out in Schoharie County where we've had gas pipeline, you know, blow-ups, and people have been hurt. The company, Constitution Pipeline, has already altered the route a little bit. At one point, they were going to go across the Capital Region BOCES facility out there, and that's the place where the kids are are experiment with the backhoes to dig up.
Good idea. Good idea.
So obviously, they rerouted that.
Yeah, but yeah, let's move it from the backhoes. Let's put it near the daycare center, will you?
But it's a huge project. It's something that's kind of gone underneath the radar in the Capital District. It's something we're watching out in Schoharie County, and again through the Southern Tier, and it will end in the town of Wright, which is Schoharie County, and then it will connect with existing pipelines and go east.
This reminds me of just in the name of like how we name wars, but the Constitution Pipeline.
Was it a company? I mean,
yeah, that is the name of the company.
Right.
Yeah. Okay.
But you name it. I mean, you know.
I mean, what are you going to do? Like rape the environment pipeline? That's come on, that's not going to work, John.
But like, you know, like Reynolds Pipeline would be, you know, innocuous, right?
In doing the research for this, have you guys found that it's strongly against, or is there a significant pocket of people in Schoharie who are for this?
You know, Schoharie County is not densely populated, so we have not heard any strong opposition other than from these groups about the pipeline itself. You know, we're getting balanced messages from out there. Some people, in general, I mean, this whole fracking issue is an issue out there as well, because there's tips of the Marcellus Shale that comes up into Schoharie County. So you have landowners who potentially could lease their property and make some money, and they think that that's important. But at the same time, you have some towns out there that are concerned about, you know, big trucks and the impacts the drilling would have. So, but the pipeline itself, I mean, the natural gas that they're going to be piping is from Pennsylvania, where the fracking is already.
Are these groups
place.
From Pennsylvania, or are they New York based?
The companies,
the groups, the grassroots groups.
No, they're grassroots. They're
from around here.
From around
local
here.
Groups. Okay.
Yep, local groups. And it's a fascinating issue. We're starting to see some of the local towns out there, you know, talk about it at the town board level. But this idea that the property owners need a little bit of help because they're intimidated by the land surveyors, I don't know how much that's true. The pipeline company says they're willing to work with people. People shouldn't be afraid that they're just surveying the property. But of course, surveying usually leads to
other things.
A couple of really interesting story, and obviously one we'll be following and watching. A couple of things before we go to a break real quick. Comment on the airlines. Jenna writes, I had to fasten my seatbelt for your comments about the airlines. I'm a flight attendant for a major international carrier, and I did safety work for years. I'm sympathetic to the many ideas discussed regarding the usage of personal electronic devices. However, other comments remind me of how safe flying really is, in that we have become so casual about seemingly unimportant safety requirements, especially with U.S. carriers. I recall flying years ago with an Asian carrier who stowed their carry-on bags against the main cabin doors. I flew on a Latin American carrier in which I could see the ground through the floorboards. I'm not kidding. Passengers count on a safe takeoff and landing. Flight crews are trained to plan for a crash every single takeoff and landing. In a crash under many Gs, the distance of your chest to the tray makes a difference in how hard you will be impacted. Whether your tray table is up or down may determine if you or the person between you and the window escapes a burning cabin. Rosemary was obviously not on my carrier. We often water in all cabins and at least once an hour internationally. Okay, I can unfasten my seatbelt now, says Jana. So
that, you know, that's excellent, and maybe that shows some of my real distaste for this. That's more information that I've ever gotten on any airplane. You don't like to be treated like a child. Do this because I say so. Boy. Do it because here's the reason. There's a reason for the rule. That's the first time I've ever heard it. Thank you very much.
You know, that's a great point.
I'm so glad I don't have to do the rants today. It's just nice to have somebody else doing the rants. It's really good.
Luca writes, while you are cynically jibing at government ineffectiveness, you should consider how much of government's effectiveness has been diminished by Republican cost cutting. And we also have this note that says, I'm still laughing about Rosemary's airline travels and travails. I love her honesty and humor. I love the female perspective of both Judy and Rosemary. Thank you. So there you go. We'll take a
right
break.
Right on, sister.
Thank you for being girls.
We have some other letters I'll get to in a second about the drug shortages and other things. And then we'll wrap up with our final topic of today. We'll be right back after the short break.
Support for WMC comes from St. Mary's Healthcare, Amsterdam, New York. Offering minimally invasive spine surgery, choose stmarys.com. And Kripalu Center for Yoga and Health, a nonprofit educational retreat center located in the Berkshires, offering yoga, personal growth, and healthy living programs, kripalu.org.
Welcome back to the roundtable. A couple of things before we go on. First of all, I want to, this is November 1st, and this is this month is the 50th anniversary of the assassination of John F. Kennedy, which took place on November 22nd, 1963. We are, not surprisingly, one of the things that we started to note that I think the interest in this from people, you know, we've had an interest in the story for forever, and we are reaching a point where so many of us, myself included, who are not even alive for this event, and want to know more. And as a result, and sure, because of some commercialism as well, I can't even tell you how many new books there are on the Kennedy assassination and about the Kennedy, about JFK and about the Kennedy assassination. So what we thought we would do is from now until the 22nd each day, focus on a different perspective and a different book. And we're going to start that today. Right. And each of these segments will be in our from 11:30 to 12 o'clock from now through the 22nd of November.
There's 22 books.
Well, it's without weekends. Oh, well, so, true. Yeah. So it's 16, actually.
Wow.
And we start off today with Jeff Greenfield, the journalist who is with ABC now, I believe, or CNN,
right.
I guess,
CNN.
And was with CBS and then to ABC. And he has written a book that looks to answer the question, what if Kennedy lived? And we will talk to Jeff Greenfield in our segment this morning. And we have incredible, incredible historians, incredible conspiracy theorists. We have incredible people who have worked in the administration and talking about the legacy of Kennedy in the 50 years, a lot of different perspectives. And we tried to find just a wide swath of interesting commentary on the subject. So we'll be presenting those throughout the month of November. So I just wanted to mention that programming note. Also, We got this note from Beth, who says, pharmacists are responsible for knowing the status of medications in our healthcare system, not doctors. Not that this is very obviously, admittedly. Most drugs that suffer shortages are generic drugs where market forces do not support ongoing production and willingness to pay higher raw material prices. Otherwise, there is a major issue, such as a key manufacturing plant is down for quality issues or raw material shortage. And the third point Beth makes is a large portion of these drugs are oncology drugs, very toxic, high sterility requirements for your safety, and also not lucrative. So we
mentioned
that.
Thank you. That's a great letter.
As well. Final issue for up for discussion in our final moments this morning. I just thought this was an interesting political story, and you know, Alan's away, and he'll be back a week after next. But I wish he were here, because I'd love to talk to him about it. But it's the whole thing about the Washington Post reports that in stump speeches. There's by Bill and Hillary Clinton over the last couple of weeks, the last two or three weeks, there have been these very subtle and then not so subtle changes, and have offered the sharp criticism of the partisan gridlock paralyzing Washington, signaling a potential 2016 campaign theme. Both Bill and Hillary Clinton in recent days have been explicitly aiming their criticism to congressional Republicans. But their remarks also seem to contain an implicit rebuke of President Obama's failure to change Washington as he pledged when first running for the White House. The argument suggests a way that Hillary Clinton could attempt to run in 2016 as an agent of change, potentially putting her at odds with the two-term Democrat that she would be seeking to replace, which I just found to be interesting.
And why did you think it was interesting?
I think it's interesting because that, you know, at some point you're going to have to see, at some point those moves are going to have to be made, right? So this would be the point that where those moves are being made.
It would be very strange if the Clintons were saying, oh, Obama's done a great job, we're going to do exactly the same. That would not be a smart move.
But they have been, they have been incredibly supportive of the administration through the first, I mean, she was a key player in the administration.
He did wonders for him during the last
election. Absolutely. Through the last election. And also that it's a united front, that it is both the former president of the United States and the former secretary of state and senator from New York basically on the same page in their review.
It's understandable, but ironic, but politics is always ironic, it seems. Of course, they've got to run on the idea that you need to compromise more, that the current system isn't working well. Of course, that's going to happen. But if you look back, I mean, they had the same kind of issues that Obama's having now.
Yeah. Notice you didn't say blatant blasting.
No,
you said not subtle yet. And not so subtle. I don't know. I don't think that their criticism is anything that
the
Obama
words they use is
not
implicit.
Agree with.
Yeah,
implicit. I mean, it's just it was like a Washington Post article. They just had to write about something. I don't see anything really. Do you see anything unusual about that? Look at our comments on this. Of course, she's distancing herself a bit, but she's done that physically by leaving the jobs just so that she can do exactly the same thing. Come on.
You know, call me naive, but I was surprised that they're out there stumping now. But I understand that they're working for candidates trying to get elected next week.
Yeah.
Right.
And certainly no surprise of the arguments regarding the shutdown and taking on congressional Republicans. But, you know. That ends our panel for this morning. We thank everybody for being with us and for sending a lot of letters. See, we said we want a lot of letters, and we told people to, you know, to
talk about airlines. That brings in the letters.
Yeah, that's right. We're
not going to put up with this anymore.
We always said language pet peeves, and now we can add airlines.
Yeah. Tray up, tray down. I mean, the whole show.
Stir, mix, and enjoy. Rosemary, Judy, Ray, thank you very much. Have a great weekend. We'll be back on Monday.
Okay.